Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Say Something teaches students how to look for warning signs, signals, and threats on social media and in their schools. And this week is a national campaign, actually, Say Something Week. It is highlighted as well by the national nonprofit based right here in Connecticut, Sandy Hook Promise. And welcoming back to the show this morning is the co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise. That's Nicole Hockley. She is here this morning. We have shared Nicole's story on our show before. Her beautiful son, Dylan, was one of the victims of the Newtown tragedy. And we're so glad to have Nicole here this morning. Thanks for being here, Nicole. How are you?
Thank you very much. And it's good to be here.
So, Nicole, tell us about Say Something and how Sandy Hook really has taken this into schools across the country.
So Say Something is a really important program to empower students with the ability to recognize when someone needs help and then get an intervention. We know that in so many acts of violence, there are all these warning signs that are given off, but we just don't know how to recognize them and then what to do if we see them. So teaching kids across the country how to be an upstander, how to lean in when someone needs help and get them the help that they need is a very empowering tool for them, but also has created significant impact in terms of bullying interventions and suicide interventions and school shooting interventions as well.
Our crime prevention expert who comes on our show on a weekly basis talks a lot about See Something, Say Something. And I'm curious, Nicole, if you could give kind of an example. You know, when you say that if kids see something, what are they kind of looking for? Are we talking about things that seem off? Are we talking about something that seems like a red flag? Like, what are kind of the beginning steps that students are learning about with something that they could see on social media, for example, or in their schools?
So a lot of what we teach is that these signs can be very, very overt and very in your face, like actual threats of I'm bringing a gun to school tomorrow, or I am cutting myself right now, or I don't want to live anymore. But then there's also these more covert type signs or more hidden signs that do rely on someone saying, you know, they're acting differently. They're giving away their possessions. They're being bullied, or they're acting out, or they're overreacting to simple situations. They don't know how to resolve conflicts. These are signs that someone could need help dealing with something that's going on in their life. So we teach the kids, what does it look like in social media as well? What does it mean in terms of pictures that people are putting up? And when should you be concerned? And we're not asking kids to take the actions themselves. We're saying, you know, go to a trusted adult or use your school's anonymous reporting system so that the experts can take that intervention for you. But your job as the eyes and ears of your school on social media and amongst your peer group is to say, you know, someone's acting a little weird. They're making me concerned, but this is something that is not normal behavior for them, and I'm afraid something's going on and I want them to be helped.
Now, you'll hear sometimes, Nicole Hockley is here, the co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise. You'll hear sometimes where kids are nervous to speak up because what if they're wrong? What if they say, you know, oh, well, this person who's always very bubbly and happy and outgoing, you know, has been very reserved the last couple of days, and they report it. You know, they report it. They say, I feel like this person is very depressed. There's something going on. And it turns out, you know, that person maybe lost their grandmother that week or something, and they totally missed the boat, for example. I know that's a fear that kids have, so they say nothing. What would you say to those examples where kids are nervous to say anything at all because they're worried they're going to be wrong? And in some cases, maybe they are, but in other cases, they may be right on the money.
Exactly. And you know, it's okay to be wrong. If you're seeing a significant behavioral shift in someone, for example, they could be sliding into depression or dealing with a family issue, getting them help is not a bad thing. It's not necessarily saying that everyone who is acting in that way is potentially, you know, ideating on suicide or anything like that, but they need some help. And it's not about snitching on someone to try to get them into trouble. It's about saying something in order to get them help. And I'd rather people be wrong in that no, my friend is actually totally fine. She was just having a bad day. Because let's face it, we all have bad days. Mm-hmm. But maybe there's something else going on. And, you know, just scratching below the surface a little bit can really help that child to open up as well as to what's going on so that they can get the intervention they need. And certainly it's better to say something than to not say something and then have an act, you know, a tragic act happen.
Do you feel like, Nicole, enough was done with See Something, Say Something in the situation of Sandy Hook?
No, I don't. And that's partially why, you know, why this program exists and to teach school kids across the country how to recognize something and then say something, because there were warning signs that the Sandy Hook shooter gave off throughout his life, and there were not enough interventions made. And had an intervention been made at an earlier stage, this might not have escalated into the massive tragedy that it became. So this is about early upstream violence prevention, seeing someone that needs help and leaning in. And you know, when we study other acts of mass violence and other shootings, and certainly suicide and self-harm, such as cutting, there are often warning signs that are recognizable and actionable when we know what to look for and how to act.
So the reason I ask that, Nicole, is because I also think it kind of leads to my next question, which is, I know that the intervention that Sandy Hook promised, it goes into the schools, which I think is so important that we are getting this into the minds of students. I think it's incredibly important. But I'm wondering, you know, are there, do you think, steps going forward as well for adults? You know, I find sometimes, you know, for example, with Sandy Hook, even with, unfortunately, some of the shootings we've seen at schools in this past year, the parents had warning signs.
Yes.
The parents of shooters have warning signs, and either they blatantly ignore them or they just don't want to believe my kid has a problem. So my question to you on a professional level is, you know, is there something more that can be done to also get the See Something, Say Something campaign out to adults and not being naive to the idea of maybe my kid needs help and that's okay. I'd rather get them the help than to deny it and end up in a situation like a Sandy Hook.
Absolutely. I mean, adults have a key role here. We're training the students. However, we know that students often bring these lessons back to their parents, and parents can go to our website and download our Know the Signs brochure anyway and teach themselves what to look for. But certainly if your child's coming home and saying, you know, my friend is acting in this way and I'm concerned, what should I do? As a trusted adult, you need to take action. And certainly if you're seeing it in your own child, denying that they need help is not going to help your son or daughter. Getting them the help that they need, whether that's about self-harm, depression, bullying, or other acts of violence, you can't deny that when your child needs help, you need to lean in and help them. Mm-hmm. So you can't pretend that everything is always rosy. We all want to think that our children are perfect, but they're hurting sometimes. And we are, as parents, have that responsibility to lean in and help them so that they don't take that hurt that they're feeling and potentially hurt themselves further or others. It's a hard one, I know, but it's an important responsibility for every parent to do. So yes, this is, we're teaching it in schools, but parents have a role to play as well in learning the signs and talking to their kids about them and also looking out for them in their own child, because every child needs help at some point.
Nicole Hockley is here, the co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise, and we're talking about the Say Something campaign. It's something that Sandy Hook Promise has brought into so many schools. It's a national campaign, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, Nicole. Since the creation of Sandy Hook Promise and the many, many schools across the nation that has adopted the work that you guys do, how has this messaging helped? How, you know, have we averted crises like a Sandy Hook in other schools across the country from these kinds of trainings?
Yes, we absolutely have. And we're very careful about how we share those stories of impact numbers, because, you know, it's very hard to quantify something that didn't happen.
Sure.
However, we know for a fact that in addition to thousands of mental health interventions as a result of Say Something and its companion programs as well, that we've also averted at least 296 suicide attempts, 7 planned school shootings that have been stopped, and at least 60 other acts of violence in schools with a weapon. So, you know, those 7 averted school shootings, there are probably more acts that we are not aware of or that we're not able to fully say this was a fully thought out plan with means and access, so it might not have happened. But the seven plans that we absolutely know have averted, that's a number that I keep with me every day.
Nicole, if there are schools listening this morning, if there are families in communities who think, you know, this is something I want incorporated in my kids' curriculum, this is something I want brought into my schools. For example, I know there are some schools that have like the DARE program still. There are still schools mm-hmm. that have mock crashes during, you know, the prom season. If someone is hearing what you're saying and they want it incorporated in their schools, maybe they want to present it to their school boards, how can they learn more? Is it something they can request from you guys, or where can they go to learn more?
Absolutely. So anyone can go to our website, sandyhookpromise.org, and get immediate access to our online interactive learning center. And for some schools, that is all that they need, because all of the curriculum and all of the activity support and resource guides are there, so they can teach it themselves within the schools, or they can speak to us and we can help them train, or, you know, train the trainer, or go into the school and train, or even through virtual live, beam our presenters into classrooms. We're here to help, and everything that we do is at no cost to school. So money is not a barrier here. It only takes, you know, around 30 minutes for us to train your kids, and you will immediately see the results.
That's so beautiful. Nicole Hockley, the co-founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise, we thank you for coming on during Say Something Week. We thank you for the work that you, your nonprofit, all of your workers do, not just here, but across the nation. And I appreciate you giving us the time here on WICC.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
So the big news this morning, if you want to call it the big news, is that Governor Lamont seems to want to drop the gas tax, or he's calling it like a holiday. A gas tax holiday. And I couldn't wait to talk about this morning because I got some mixed feelings on it. So joining me this morning is Senator Ryan Fazio. Ryan has been on the show before many times. He represents the 36th District here in Connecticut, so kind of like the Greenwich area. And he actually serves on the tax committee, the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee. So, Ryan, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Always welcome to the show. So it sounds like there's bipartisan support on this gas tax holiday. So that's good news, right? I mean, we kind of have an agreement-ish going on.
Of course. We always look for a silver lining. And last week, the Republicans from the House and the Senate held a press conference to ask the governor to do just this. And it seems like there's support from the Democratic leadership just a week later. So I think that's a positive. I mean, middle-class consumers are really, really hurting in Connecticut because of the inflation off of the already high cost of living. So something needs to be done. And I think this is a start.
I love that you say it's a start, because that's where my hesitation comes from this morning. Senator Fazio, I think what's hard about this, and what I'm sure my listeners and even myself as a taxpayer, it kind of feels like, so why now? Because when you hear it, it's what, 25 cents a gallon, essentially, about 25 cents that's going to be knocked off with this gas tax?
About, yes.
Okay.
About, yes.
So we're at an average of about $4.50 a gallon right now, which essentially just brings us back to where we were last week, kind of, which was something that I think people kind of felt like, well, why are we waiting till now, and is it really going to make a difference? What would you say to that?
I think they're right, and it could have even been worse. I was elected in a special election last summer, and one of the biggest issues of contention between me and not only my opponent, but the leadership of the legislature and the governor is that I was opposed to a new gas tax, the TCI, which could mm-hmm. have imposed another 20 cents per gallon of taxes for consumers. You know, our caucus has also proposed a 2-year reduction in the sales tax to 6% from 6.35%. But more importantly, over many years, Connecticut has become increasingly expensive due to regulations, due to taxes, where the politicians who run the state continue to put the burden of government on, again, middle-class taxpayers, rather than forcing themselves to make tough decisions on budgetary issues, on regulatory issues, and so on, to the point that Connecticut's one of the most expensive states to live in and has some of the highest taxes in the entire country. And this was the ultimate reason I decided to run for office last year, because the policies of Connecticut leaders over many years have just really, really hurt the middle class. It's destroyed jobs, it's destroyed opportunity, and sent people fleeing from the state. And obviously, it's been difficult for years, but with the inflation nationally on top of it all, it's really coming to a head. But we've also seen now that the leadership of, say, the Labor Committee in the legislature wants to impose dozens of new regulations. On the Tax Committee, we're still entertaining more proposals to raise taxes. So I don't think the people who lead the state and have led the state for years have quite learned the lesson, even as inflation is rising faster and faster.
And I think what's also infuriating, Senator Fazio, is that when you're constantly, as a taxpayer, I feel like it's thrown in our face all the time how much money Connecticut has. You know, we hear about this very healthy rainy day fund. Oh, my gosh, we're one of the only states that actually did well during the pandemic. And, you know, President Biden loves Connecticut. I mean, he sent us so many federal dollars, more than most states have gotten across the country. So if we have all this dang money, if I do say so myself, why are we getting so little back? You know, like I look at the sales tax, for example. You brought up the sales tax. Great idea. We're getting a week. We're getting a sales tax holiday for a week in April. I don't. That's almost insulting versus being like, oh, wow. Thank you so. Gee willikers. Thank you so much for that 1 week. It feels insulting, honestly, as a taxpayer in Connecticut.
Exactly. Our standards have become so low here in Connecticut.
So low.
They should be much higher. And, you know, again, people talk about the rainy day fund and some of the short term windfall to the government. That's largely because of the inflation and because of the deficit spending from Washington, D.C. that's sent a lot of aid to states to every state. But over a dozen states across the country in the last 2 years have actually cut taxes in a broad way, whereas Connecticut hasn't, because they're, I think, even more economically and fiscally prudent than we are. But we need, I think, short-term relief to people's budgets. I think the gas tax and the sales tax that our Republican caucus has proposed for 6 months and 2 years respectively are the type of relief to people's budgets during this period of inflation. In the long run, we also need reforms to our regulations, to our income tax code in Connecticut that can reduce cost of living in a permanent way and create jobs and raise incomes in a permanent way, like Connecticut has not seen in a very, very long time, perhaps even my lifetime. We need a wholesale way of a wholesale change in our mindset and our policy for the long term that allows Connecticut to grow, that allows people to raise a family here and afford to do so. And that's going to require much more than just a temporary change in the gas tax or a temporary change in the sales tax. Here, we need a mindset change. We need wholesale policy change in Connecticut.
We're chatting this morning with Senator Ryan Fazio, who represents the 36th District. And we're chatting about this gas tax holiday, if you want to call it that, a holiday on the gas tax, which is going to extend until June 30th. By the way, it hasn't even been voted on yet. There is bipartisan support, but it's not like if you go to the pumps today, you'll see that relief just yet. I know the governor plans to hopefully have that all taken care of by the end of this week. But either way, we're talking about this gas tax. Now, Senator Fazio, you said before the break you want to see basically sweeping tax cuts in Connecticut, more than just this gas tax, you know, income taxes, things like that. What are the chances, though, with the current administration and with having a majority in Hartford? What are the chances that that will happen? I mean, when you look at the gas tax, you know, essentially, Hartford dragged its feet on it for 2 weeks. This, you know, the war has been going on. And even before the Russian attack, there were calls for the sales tax to go away. I mean, we had Senator Kelly on, I feel like, in February calling on that, maybe even earlier. So what do you think are the chances that we'll see some of the things that you had mentioned, you know, these sweeping tax cuts?
As you say, I think with the current configuration of the legislature, with the large majorities with the other party, it's low. But our party, you mentioned Senator Kelly, led with a proposal, and our friends on the other side of the aisle did accept it. So that's a positive. And we're going to continue to announce the right proposals on any number of issues and try to work with our friends across the aisle to gain agreement. But again, I think on a lot of major issues, there remains a lot of distance between us. And even on some of the other tax issues, the governor's proposals are very narrow. They're very tailored towards specific constituencies. For instance, the governor says that, and some of the leaders in the legislature say that they want a small automobile tax cut. But really, it's not a tax cut. They're going to find $100 million of new spending to give to municipalities whose mill rates are already above 29 mills on just the cars that residents own. Well, that wouldn't help any residents in southwestern Connecticut, because everyone in Greenwich, Stamford, New Canaan, which are my constituencies, already have property taxes under 29 mills. So the people in our district will actually see their state tax burden go up in order to fund a car tax cut for people who live in high tax municipalities. So there's just, it seems to be there's gimmicks after gimmicks of very narrow policies that benefit narrow constituencies. I believe in fair treatment, broad-based policies that help the middle class across the state from corner to corner, not just people who live in our neck of the woods. Regular people, type of people who don't have a lobbyist, who aren't part of an interest group, haven't gotten a break in the state in a very long time. And so our policies should be aimed at benefiting them. They should be aimed at encouraging people to build a life in Connecticut, to create jobs in Connecticut, to work in Connecticut, to invest in Connecticut. And that can only occur if you choose the best policies, if you choose the fairest and the most broad-based policies. I think we have to do something in the long run about the complexity and the high income tax rate in our state. We have to try to alleviate some of the red tape that's constricting small businesses. When I talk to small businesses in my community, they are getting crushed. They can't find workers. They can't find materials. Prices are rising. People are moving out of the state. We have to do something about healthcare costs. We have to do something about utility costs, which continue to be the highest in the continental U.S., even after our friends on the other side of the aisle passed a electricity reform last summer and touted it as take back our grid. Well, you're going to see your electricity bill go up again in the near future. So there's so much that we need to tackle in order to alleviate the burdens on the middle class, and that's going to require a lot of work and a new attitude in Hartford that I'm not quite sure exists yet.
Senator Vazio, my last question for you, because we had Senator Duff on the show yesterday and we talked about the gas tax. This was before the announcement came out, obviously. But one of the things he and I think a lot of Democrats were worried about was the idea of getting rid of the gas tax was going to now cut into the funding for essentially our road projects here in Connecticut. I think by having the gas tax gone till the end of June, it's some $100 million or something like that. I think that's what I was reading. And I'm curious, you know, didn't we just get federal funding for infrastructure? And quite frankly, I think if you were to ask any Connecticut resident who lives here, like you know, you say that you haven't seen a lot of changes since you've lived here. I've also been here for 30 plus years of my life, and I think I still see the same construction work on the Merritt Parkway still 30 years later. So I wasn't sure what your thoughts were on even the money that apparently is going to our roads, and that's why they were kind of hesitant to get rid of the gas tax for even longer than June 30th.
Yeah, how much money do these people need?
I don't know.
I guess now I'm one of these people.
Now you're one of us.
Connecticut spends the most per capita on transportation of any state in the continental U.S. In tax dollars. The money's there. And then you mentioned the federal money on top of it all. There was also a new highway mileage tax that was imposed last summer, lest we forget that, too, of about $90 million a year. There's plenty of money for these politicians to spend. They don't need any more of it. They actually deserve less of it so they can make or are forced to make more prudent and intelligent decisions. Connecticut has a lot of regulations also and red tape that raise the cost of construction and renovation and building infrastructure that they probably help a few special interests by inflating the price tag, but they certainly don't help the regular taxpayers. They don't fill the potholes in Stamford. They don't quicken up 95 Metro North or 95. So we could spend all the money that we're taking from regular taxpayers, regular people, much more wisely. But it's going to take more fundamental reforms. No gimmicks. We actually need long-term reforms that are going to reduce the cost. But absolutely, there is no justification for new taxes, new revenue. But again, let's not have our memories be so short. Last summer, the majority party passed a new highway mileage tax. In 2019, the majority party passed about $1 billion a year of new taxes. They wanted to last year impose a new gas tax called the Transportation Climate Initiative. They wanted to impose tolls totaling about $800 million a year in 2019 and 2020. This is very recent history. Things are bad. They could have been even worse if the people who are currently in power got their way in every way. So going forward, we need a total change in attitude. We need a total change in how we approach government. We need to lift the burdens on middle-class families, and we needed to start doing it yesterday.
Yeah, because I think, you know, Senator Fazio, I think we're going to get to a point where people just have had it and we're going to see a mass exodus. I really do. I think Connecticut is kind of reaching that point where unless you come from a lot of either old money or you have a multi-million dollar corporation or something, I just think the middleman is... I mean, I got to be honest with you, Senator Fazio. I mean, as a woman in her 30s with dual income with my husband and only one child, I mean, we debated all the time. Do we stay in Connecticut? Now, I love my job. I love being near my family. I grew up in Connecticut, but it's just it's criminal. I mean, it truly is criminal to live in Connecticut a little bit. It's hard to not feel that way.
That's right. And that's you and people like you should be exactly the target of government policies. People are playing by the rules, who are doing the right thing, who just want to raise a family and be able to afford to live here. You know, the people in power are always talking about helping one group or another, narrow reforms. It should be based on regular middle-class people who are doing the right thing, who pay their taxes, who want to build a family and a life here, and just haven't gotten a break. That should be the goal here, and it hasn't been for a long time.
Senator Fazio, we so appreciate all the time you gave us this morning. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again really soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too. So weeks and weeks and weeks ago, I got a phone call during my show when I was on with either Senator Blumenthal or Congressman Himes. I can't remember. Probably Senator Blumenthal. And it was a local restaurant owner who said, Melissa, I'm struggling. I literally am not going to be able to stay in my building for much longer. And my heart broke for him. And then I said, well, do you mind me asking what restaurant you own? Do you mind just taking a second? And he said Black Rock Social House, which blew my mind, because when Black Rock Social House opened, my husband and I went pretty soon after and thought the food was amazing. The drinks were great. The atmosphere was so fun. It was very much up our alley, and it fit perfectly with Black Rock. It was perfect. It was a very Fairfield County, I thought, very fitting, cool place, really. So when I found out that they were struggling immensely, I was completely shocked. And I thought, well, if these guys are struggling, imagine how many other restaurants are going through the same thing, if not worse. So I wanted to have Mark on the show. Mark Tarosi is the owner of Black Rock Social House. And I wanted him to come on the show, talk a little bit about his business and sort of the journey he's gone through since opening during COVID. So, Mark, welcome to the show. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
It is So great to hear from you again, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm great. I'm really great. And you'll be happy to know that I survived just fine the next morning after having the margarita flight at your restaurant. I did okay. I was in good shape that next morning. I was kind of shocked. I still made it to church. So there you go. It was okay.
You didn't need much help having that flight either. You did very well taking care of that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, friend. So, Mark, for people who don't know, you came actually from the West Coast, came to Connecticut, and you opened this restaurant. When did you open it? What inspired you? Tell us about it.
Crazy enough, I literally just celebrated my one-year anniversary 3 days ago. So our first service was on March 12th of 2021. So we've hit the one-year mark right now.
Wow. So what was that like? You opened it up during the middle of COVID.
Yeah. I've been in the industry, you know, more years than I want to, you know, admit. And in managing restaurants, and it was time for me to have my own place. And it was right around election time for the last presidential election. Both administrations were saying, hey, you know, the vaccinations are coming out. This is, you know, we're going to get them in arms, and in spring it's going to be great. And, you know, I took it as an opportunity to be able to live out my dream that I've been wanting to have for many years. So I took the proper steps and signed into a lease and began the ball rolling. And I flipped the location in Black Rock in 3 months and opened it up in March, and found an amazing team to really who believes in what hospitality stands for. And it started off wonderfully. And about 2 months after we opened up, the word Delta started swimming around, and it started affecting businesses. And, you know, obviously we had already been impacted by COVID for a year, the country has. And, you know, as the year went on, it was the cost of products started rising. Obviously, labor shortages were issues. And so the struggle just became real in late spring and into the summer of this past year. And it was quite the struggle. The Restaurant Revitalization Fund was something that was a lifeline to many businesses, not just my own, but, you know, there's still 177,000 applications that are in queue for people that desperately need this help to keep themselves afloat. Because it decimated the industry, and restaurants did everything that they could to bend and change to the rules and the regulations. And, you know, it affected people a lot. And going to a to-go delivery system is not profitable. You know, those third-party companies eat up so much money that there is no profitability or no profit margin when you're using those companies.
You mean like an Uber Eats or something, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct, yes. Okay. And it's a great system to have, and it helps save money in other areas, you know, with insurance if you're going to deliver yourself. But, you know, these companies take anywhere between 30 and 40% of the sale. And
wow.
If your profit margins are only based on 10 or 15%, you know, if you're going off of a model that's to go in delivery, you're not making much money, you know. So there hasn't been the right formula yet. Now, don't get me wrong. There's still pockets and restaurants and groups and areas that flourished and did very well in this industry. But it's definitely not cookie cutter, and not everybody has been as successful and fruitful through these past 2 years. And, you know, it's been a difficult journey. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I learned so much this past year, but it was rough. And, you know, getting into the holiday season, which is supposed to be the bread and butter of the restaurant industry, didn't happen because of Omicron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, restaurants are almost like squirrels. They, you know, during November and December, they gather in all the parties and the sales and everything else to get them through the winter season, which is traditionally slow.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't happen for many restaurants, including my own. And, you know, eviction became, unfortunately, part of the process.
So that was going to be my question. So where are you at today? I know you hit your one-year anniversary, but where does Black Rock Social House, where's the future looking? What's it looking like?
I mean, well, it's good and bad. You know, I was literally less than a week away from having to permanently shut my doors, and an amazing company by the name of InKind stepped in, and because the eviction process was very real, and it was, you know, it was going to happen. And my landlords are wonderful people. They didn't want to do it, but they had to protect their investments. So I understand why they did it, but
sure.
It still sucked, you know?
Yeah, of course.
You know, so this company stepped in at the 11th hour and helped out to clear what I had owed to the landlord. And, you know, that was just a battle in the war of keeping ourselves alive in this pandemic war that we're still fighting. Another variant is going to happen again, and it's going to affect business again. And, you know, inflation is not going down, and, you know, cost of product is still rising. The cost of chicken right now, my goodness, you know, 35 to 40% higher than it used to be. Mm-hmm. A case of limes is almost $90 right now. I mean, it's just insane, the price of product out there, and it does affect the bottom line of all restaurants that are out there. Mm-hmm. So restaurants have to adapt. But, you know, I've got the reprieve from thanks to InKind, and I couldn't appreciate it more. But we obviously still need people's help. We need the support of the local community, and, you know, we do what we can to get out into the community and become a pillar of the community. Black Rock is an amazing area.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
So eclectic and fun, and there's amazing restaurants on the Strip on Fairfield Avenue, not mm-hmm. just my own. And people need to support local, independently owned restaurants, mm-hmm. and they are the backbone of the industry, and people need their support.
We're chatting this morning with Mark Tarosi, who is the owner of Black Rock Social House in Black Rock, a very up-and-coming restaurant, if I do say so myself. My husband and I have frequented there a couple of times, and the food is absolutely delicious. And I got to say, Mark, I don't know what I love more. And as a foodie, this is very hard to say, but I got to be honest. I think your staff might take the cake on this one. Your food is excellent. The drinks are great. The atmosphere is very cool. But you have one of the nicest staff crew I think I've ever met in a Connecticut restaurant. I'm serious. They're so attentive. They're so kind. They love what they do. They love you. And they're just very, I don't know. I was, both Derek and I were floored by your staff. It was very, they're very impressive. I would be very proud of them.
I am a very lucky man. I was very upfront and honest and open with the staff through the hiring process on who I was looking for, the type of person and the mindset I was looking for. You know, over the past 2 years with the pandemic, you know, the term hospitality had kind of gone through the wayside. A lot of people ordering to go, or if it was for here, there was just almost like this cloud of, overcast of just not being able to relax and socialize and be yourself. And so our staff is there to make sure that when you walk in the door that you feel like you are the center of the universe. And it's kind of the mantra that we have. You're there to sip, nosh, and engage with each other. You know, don't look into your phone. You're there to look into each other's eyes and socialize as a community and as friends and as family. And when you walk into the restaurant, you're made to feel like you're home. And that's, I have an amazing staff. I'm very, very lucky.
Yeah, they're really, really great. And for people who've never been at your restaurant, Mark, you know, describe some of the food, some of the items. What are you known for?
Absolutely. And thank you. Great question. International comfort food is the concept. You know, kind of think back to when you were a kid and whoever it was that cooked in your family. What was that one item that they cooked that when you knew you were going to have it for dinner that night, you were all excited about? You know, those stick to your ribs type of food items that just bring back memories. And so you look at our menu, you look at all of these stick to your ribs family home recipes of deliciousness. And our chef, Jacob Braith II, has a knack of being able to figure that out. You know, he's got a couple of things to balance. Number one, culture, because we touch on cultures from around the world. We have a food culture series that we actually choose a country somewhere in the world every month, and we do all of our specials from the cuisine of that country. So he has a lot of homework that he does at the beginning of each week or each month when we're figuring out what country we're highlighting. And it's just a lot of fun, and he loves the challenge. And then to top it all off, and it's something that we don't, you know, advertise from the rooftops, but we are also 100% gluten-free. And I know there is still a negative stigma to what gluten-free cuisine is about, but naturally 85% of all foods is gluten-free. It's just those ingredients that we add to stuff that kick it out of the safe zone for those that might have celiac or those that have are not comfortable eating gluten. But we're redefining what gluten-free cuisine is all about. And, you know, unless we told you, you walk into that restaurant and sit down, you would never know that we were 100% gluten-free.
I didn't know that, actually.
It's a safe space for a lot to eat.
I was not aware
really?
Of that. No, I didn't know that. Uh-uh. I didn't catch that at all. But I don't think it mattered to me because we are, like you said, I would most of the food that we do eat is kind of already gluten-free, not because we need to be, but because we're very veggie heavy and, you know, meat heavy and all that. So that's no, I had no idea. But now, and as I'm looking at your menu, you're absolutely right. That's so, wow, that's very cool. I love that, Mark. That's very, very cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a great concept. It's different. It's something that's outside of the box. It's not just your traditional, you know, there are so many Italian restaurants and sushi restaurants and Chinese restaurants. We touch on all cultures from around the world, and it's an always evolving menu. So it's always something new and fresh and fun.
Yeah, it really is. Let me know when you guys decide to do a South African menu, because I miss a good braai or like even a good ostrich burger or something. Let me know when you want to do South Africa. I could help you out.
We will be doing South Africa. We did Ethiopia last year. We touch on every continent of the world, and it's a lot of fun. It really is.
Yeah, and you guys do such a good job. The food is ridiculous. Like, I'm still dreaming of the escargot. It was unbelievable. It was
Thank
so
you.
Good.
Oh, yeah. You're so sweet.
No, it was so good. So, Mark, what is your website? Where are you located? I want to make sure people go and check you guys out.
Absolutely. So our address is 2895 Fairfield Avenue, right in the heart of Black Rock in Bridgeport, right on the Bridgeport-Fairfield line. And our website is blackrocksocialhouse.com. Please follow us on Instagram and on Facebook, because we do update our menu changes and our promotions. We do live music every week. Beginning in May, we're going to be doing our rooftop concerts for the Black Rock community again. So we'll have live bands performing on our roof overlooking our parking lot. We get the local restaurants that are surrounding the area as well. We all get in on this. So it's almost like a block party atmosphere to it. So it just helps support local businesses and the small businesses that are on Fairfield Avenue. And it's such a great time. Our drag queen bingo, we do once a month, a bingo brunch the last Saturday of the month. And my goodness, we raise funds for the Imperial Sovereign Court of all Connecticut and for the New Haven Pride Center. Last year, we raised over $8,000 doing these drag brunches. And they're so much fun. And we raise so much great money for nonprofit organizations. We like to get out into the community and give back.
All right. Well, Mark, we so appreciate all the work that you do. Keep at it, please, because we love you guys. And I hope you guys keep on going and trucking on. And thank you for coming on this morning. Appreciate it.
I can't thank you enough for this opportunity, Melissa. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And please, please support small restaurants and local businesses. We still need your help.
Amen to that. Mark, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk again soon.